welcome to Off the Page, the podcast where we take the words off the page and into your ears. As always, this episode of Off the Page will contain pieces written by the members of the Creative Writing Society at the University of Nottingham. You can visit uncws.com to find out more about the society and to visit our blog to read even more pieces by the members. So once again, welcome to Off the Page. Hi everybody, welcome to this episode of Off the Page. I'm your host, Madeline Roach, and in the room we have got some lovely creative writers who are going to introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Matt.
Hi, I'm Ed.
Hi, I'm Ravi.
Hi, I'm Philippa.
I am Catherine.
I'm Charlotte.
This is Off the Page.
So, to kick us off for this episode, we're going to have a nice piece by Ed.
So, this is a relatively short piece that is currently still provisionally titled Potion Making, and I quite like that. So, anyway, there are many who say that simply acquiring it is the hardest part, so difficult and so dangerous as to render the entire exercise all but pointless. Retrieval, that is the first step. One must first gather the requisite ingredients, one rare and one so commonplace as to fall from the heavens above, but the former is only to be found half the known world away, past the edge on the very cusp of the unknown. Deep within steaming jungle and up the sides of temperate mountains, one must venture, or pay others to go in your stead, in search of small, dark, violet fruits, ripening as they will. Hand and eye of whoever so seeks them must be discerning to the utmost, for only the ripest and most ready fruit will produce the desired effect. Anything else will, in almost all cases, fall short. Substandard is as substandard does. Next is a period of relative ease. The fruits must be gathered and fleshed, reddish indigo carcasses discarded, perhaps set aside for alternative use, if one is of a wasteless mind. For it is stone that is the purpose of the effort, and provides the second ingredient. One, however, does not simply mix wheat with yeast and water to make bread. Firstly, the ingredients must be prepared. For common water, this is artless, heat, applied liberally until the boil, the basis of almost all creations, based on the simple, ubiquitous liquid. But for the active compound, for the secret and powerful reagent, a more complex and subtle process is required. The seeds of the fruit must be dried, beneath the sun is best, and preferably in the baking heat of their natural lands. Then fire must be stoked, an oven prepared, and they must be roasted in order to unlock the magical potency contained within. A delicate process that requires skill and practice, not to overdo and thus ruin the final precious harvest. After, it is time to ship them back across the seas to the laboratory, or the kitchen, for the final processes are Byzantine. Mortar and pestle are now required, the alchemist's staple, to grind and grind and grind the dried and roasted kernels into a fine powder. The powder of many varieties of the roasted nuts may be blended to alter the final properties of the potion, or kept pure, though this is mostly cosmetic, taste-enhancing phenomena. Finally, it is time for combination. This process is once again simple after the complexities of composing an artful blend and achieving a perfect roast. Fundamentally, it is that most simple of scientific methods. Suspension. Boiled water, cooled but slightly, added to the ground powder of the rare fruit stone. But there is an art to be found here as well, in judging of time and heat, in the selection of vessel for the combination, suspension and filtration of the grounds. Some prefer the stretch of gauze or paper, others a finely wrought mesh, some to allow the natural forces to act upon the suspension. Whilst different traditions hold that pressure may be applied to alleviate and reduce the timings, regardless, in success, the concoctor has managed to create a marvel of creation, a potion of vigour and life, energy in liquid form.
Yes.
You sound very Dave Attenbury.
Yeah.
You have a very nice reading voice. Like, it's very soothing, and you could, like, do audiobook.
Oof, there's a side hustle.
Yeah, there you go, you should do it.
It blows my mind that this is about coffee.
I'm so stupid, I did not realize that.
Yes. I was just
like, oh, nice potion.
Right? Again.
It's good.
It is good. Are these your notes?
They are.
I quite like this one. I originally said varieties of the roasted nuts and underlined, they're beans, my dude.
Oh, I may have accidentally.
You did,
nuts.
But it's okay.
I was reading this from a copy of the piece that has been annotated at our wonderful coffee shop critique session.
That everyone should come to, because the person who runs them is great.
After Ed's lovely piece, that was really nice, and I didn't realise that it was about coffee, because I'm a fool, I'm now going to read a nice little piece. Okay, so this is called Oh, It Was Nothing. I'll read it first, and then I'll tell you what it's about. She leaves the room in the dead of night. She should have left earlier, but there was such a compulsion to stay, to enjoy the warmth of that room and the lovely company for longer. She regrets it as soon as she enters onto the street, the dark, quiet, dead street. There's the gushing of water in the distance, the gentle tinkling of the wind dancing over the trees, and the soft pounding of her feet on the tarmac. She walks in time to a song she is listening to in her head to fight off the quietness, and it speeds up her pace so she can escape this derelict street as quickly as she can. There are streetlights positioned systematically down the road, but their circles of warm yellow light are distinct, individual. They do not cross over, so she gets plunged into silent darkness every couple of steps. She is in a gap between the lights, in a world of darkness when she hears it. Rustling. Her eyes are wide, scanning the dark bushes in front of her, but she cannot see anything. Her heart rate picks up. It pounds against her chest as though it does not want to be inside of her when she dies. Adrenaline dumps into her blood. Her breathing increases and her muscles push her forwards, moving faster and closer to safety. She trips and stumbles but keeps moving, the wetness of tears starting to stain her face. The rustling sounds out in the dark road once again and she stops, turns, but can't see anything. And then she runs. She runs as fast as her terrified body will carry her, runs until she is at the door to safety, and under the light of the porch, she turns and scans the darkness again. She sees the flicker of a lighter, then a small red orb in the darkness. She is confused as she stands one step from safety, the door open if she needs to enter it quickly. Then she smells it. Oh, she thinks, as she turns and enters the building. It was nothing. So, that was about how when I lived in halls in first year and my girlfriend and I had like started dating but like weren't really at the place to like start staying at each other's houses, I'd like walk back from Willoughby to Ancaster at like 2 o'clock in the morning and be absolutely terrified, and I was always like, I am going to die, and then it was just like some people smoking weed. So that's how overactive my imagination is, that I literally got terrified every time I walked back. So I was like, somebody is going to murder me. And it was just some people like getting lit.
Can we talk about Maddie's reading voice, please? I love it. You are so very talented. And we stand.
The next piece is by Matthew Bird, the president of the society.
Okay, so this piece was written at the Architecture Collab, a surprise collab. We weren't expecting Architecture to get in touch with us, but they wanted to do something with creative writing, and so we ran a lit circle on the theme of architecture, so it was kind of like a setting description kind of session, which was good. All the architects seemed to enjoy it. We even subjected them to consequences, and it was quite fun because one table, which had all architects on, when they were trying to read their consequences out, they were just in absolute hysterics. So that was fun. And this task was called Phenomenology. I'm probably saying it wrong. It was to write a piece about how a place makes a character feel, so their experience of the place. The night shift in the Ministry of Love may as well have been the day shift. There were no windows, and there was only one door. Owen pushed his cleaning cart along yet another corridor. It looked clean already, so he assumed he had already mopped this one. But if that was the case, where was the corridor he was meant to be cleaning? He grunted and turned a corner. The Ministry of Love was always deathly silent when he was on his shift. He never passed anyone, never even saw a fly. The stairways in the ministry were not simple. Some took you up 10 stories, others just one, and sometimes an unlabeled lift was the only way to move between floors. Whoever had designed it
clearly hadn't considered the caretakers. The room numbering didn't help either. He needed to clean room 478, but that was adjacent to room 704 and also room 254, so Big Brother only knew which floor the room was on, or even which floor he was on. He dusted an empty picture frame and carried along the concrete hallway. He came across the only series of doors with consecutive numbers. Room 105, 104, 103, 102. He turned a corner. He knew he would need to go there eventually, but not now. Not just yet. He continued searching for room 478, a room he was sure existed, even though it probably didn't. Reconciling this incongruity was the real work. That and cleaning. He found himself facing the large steel door for room 105 again. He must have looped around, or maybe there were duplicates of this corridor. 105, 104, 103, 102, a different corner, another empty picture frame to dust. He knew 478 existed and yet also didn't. He knew room 478 was and was not room 101.
I always do panic really well. Like, things that are, like, unsettling and, like, something's off.
I've nurtured that over my own existence.
Also, Catherine, I had the exact same reaction, but at the front of the room, because I was the one running this task.
So you said the words "Ministry of Love."
Yes.
And I've never wanted to hear those out of your mouth less. So I lost it, but silently. But it was a very good piece. I just had to have a little silent giggle to myself over those words for a bit.
Yes.
What about that choice, Matt?
Well, it's from 1984. The Ministry of Love, Room 101. Room 101 being the room where your worst nightmare is. The Ministry of Love being the Ministry of Torture, because backwards.
This is Off the Page.
Okay, well, speaking of 1984, it's time for our Book of the Week segment, and Matt has actually bought 1984 and is going to tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so 1984 by George Orwell is a classic novel. It's almost like the grandfather of dystopia. A lot of people say it's relevant for our times because there's all that kind of fake news and saying things which aren't true and yet saying that they are true. And despite the fact that everyone knows they're not true, everyone has to believe they're true, because otherwise, how can you go about life? So yes, that's 1984. And I'm going to read the first page or so, mostly because I really like the first sentence of 1984. It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. Winston Smith, his chin nuzzled into his breast in an effort to escape the vile wind, slipped quickly through the glass doors of Victory Mansions, though not quickly enough to prevent a swirl of gritty dust from entering along with him. The hallway smelt of boiled cabbage and old rag mats. At one end of it, a coloured poster, too large for indoor display, had been tacked to the wall. It depicted simply an enormous face, more than a metre wide, the face of a man of about 45, with a heavy black moustache and ruggedly handsome features. Winston made for the stairs. It was no use trying the lift. Even at the best of times, it was seldom working, and at present the electric current was cut off during daylight hours. It was part of the economy drive in preparation for Hate Week. The flat was 7 flights up, and Winston, who was 39 and had a varicose ulcer above his right ankle, went slowly, resting several times on the way. On each landing, opposite the lift shaft, the poster of the enormous face gazed from the wall. It was one of those pictures which are so contrived that the eyes follow you about when you move. "Big Brother is watching you," the caption beneath it ran. Inside the flat with a fruity voice was reading out a list of figures which had something to do with the production of pig iron. The voice came from an oblong metal plaque, like a dulled mirror which formed part of the surface of the right-hand wall. Winston turned a switch and the voice sank somewhat, though the words were still distinguishable. The instrument, the telescreen it was called, could be dimmed, but there was no way of shutting it off completely. He moved over to the window, a smallish, frail figure, the meagreness of his body merely emphasised by the blue overalls which were the uniform of the party.
His hair was very fair, his face naturally sanguine, his skin roughened by coarse soap and blunt razor blades, and the cold of the winter that had just ended. Outside, even though the shut window pane, the world looked cold. Down in the street, little eddies of wind were whirling dust and torn paper into spirals. And though the sun was shining and the sky a harsh blue, there seemed to be no colour in anything except the posters that were plastered everywhere. The black mustachioed face gazed down from every commanding corner. There was one in the house in front, immediately opposite. "Big Brother is watching you," the caption said, while the dark eyes looked deep into Winston's own.
Ooh. I've never actually read 1984, but everyone says it's really, really good.
I only read 1984 over the summer. Okay. Like, I was aware of what the themes were, but I actually realised when I was reading it that I had no idea what the plot of 1984 was, only what the setting was. Mm-hmm. It was actually quite a nice, well, not nice, but quite a well-written story, as well as a well-rounded setting. Bit of romance, bit of love interest, spies, traitors. It was a good book. Good job, Mr. Orwell.
You've done it again.
George
Orwell, he's up and coming. I keep an eye on that.
He's one to watch. I reckon he'll have at least another novel or two in him.
Ravi is going to read a piece for us now.
Hello. So this piece was written in the Adventure Lit Circle, and it is called The Candle Flickers. The gentle scent of sweat fills the cave. Nervous sweat. Anxious sweat. Pirates, each wearing a treasure map of scars and wounds that all miss that one fatal X, sit among the mounds of treasure. Their captains whisper in the middle of the room, both shaking with restrained anger. A politician's facade paints a smile on their lips as one chooses a single coin from the sea at their feet and tosses it. It spins in the air, glinting in the golden firelight. The crew watch it intently, waiting for the toss to decide their fates. But we don't care about them. Nor do we care about the treasure, the mountains of blood-stained doubloons and gemstones, nor the blazing torches that force the shadows to dance across the rock. We care about a single, solitary candle. Its small flame illuminates a smaller corner of the space, swaying slightly. It travelled for months, locked in a mass grave with its brethren, braving the cold, salt-infested waters that seeped in through the wood. They held on to each other as the waves rocked the ship, almost breaking it and them apart. They waited in the dark, waiting for the light to once again shine upon them, waiting for the darkness to come once more so that they could be light. They could glow with all the passion of fire and the restraint so few of their distant cousins can manage. It was left, alone in a cave, until the humans found it again. And now it's serving its purpose. Finally it can be ablaze. Be alive. Be... The flame wobbles. No, the candle thinks, willing itself to stay alight. Life can't be this cruel. The flame sparks. Fate cannot, will not do this to it. Fate does not care. The candle flickers and then goes out, unnoticed by those yelling at a coin, unable to do anything else but fall. Thanks.
Oofed. That's my review.
Again, very well read, very passionate.
Thanks.
It was so chilling, but I liked, I don't know, not like in a creepy way, in like a very, I love the personification of the candle as well. Really nice.
Yeah, I like that it's centered around the object of the candle.
What was the prompt for the...
Oh, it was the word association. And so because I knew it was coming, I kind of planned it like a couple of days in advance.
Oh, disgusting.
How can you plan for word association?
So during the word association, I said the word chance so that I had an excuse to write this.
Oh, that's
cheating.
I don't think it comes as a surprise to anyone when we do word association.
No, although at our speed writing mid circle, instead of doing word association, we got everyone to like write or draw a picture or like a word in each of the boxes, and then they were used as the prompt. So we don't always do word association. We always think of cool, new, fun tasks at creative writing.
Do you want to say that with a little more vitriol? I love this society.
We're super for fun.
It's amazing. Funny. Great.
Please. I do not have a
gun. The gun is pressing to my head too hard.
Submit to the blog.
No, I'm the one holding the gun when I'm like, submit to the blog.
Submit to the blog was even a catchphrase at our game show.
That was good.
Yeah.
I love that. In there blog we trust.
Right then, so the next piece is going to be by Charlotte.
So this piece is called The End of All Things Dawn. Just a content warning for this piece, there is heavy mention of death, so just be warned going ahead. Why does this feel like the end? As much as I perhaps deserve this, I'd quite like to spend more time with this family I've found. I don't know, this is harder than I expected. Now I'm here. I know you don't want me to join you this soon, but maybe I don't mind as much as I thought. It just got so much harder towards the end. I don't know if this is selfish. I don't know if I can leave them. They've given me so much more than I thought possible. I'm sorry if I'm letting you down. You always told me it was okay. If things were too hard, I can just stop. Is it okay if I stop now? I think I'm ready for this. Please. But you. You with your blue eyes. It's like when the water is so calm and clear it looks like glass. I jumped in and now the glass is shattered everywhere. I know whatever I do, wherever I go from here, I'll feel the glass slicing the bottom of my feet. It's just everywhere. You are everywhere. In me, around me, my every thought and breath. I can see the blood too, from the bottoms of my feet, it's all over the floor. It's staining my skin. If I stand here long enough, will you help me out? Please be gentle. I always thought you were delicate. But I'm afraid if you touch me, I'll crack.
That was beautiful. That was very poetic as well.
What a poetic bunch we all are.
No, we should be Poetry Society. I'm kidding. If you would like to do poetry at Creative Writing, you can also do that. We welcome everybody. If you write fiction, non-fiction, poetry, whatever you want, we welcome you.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to Charlotte's piece.
It was a very good piece. Very nice.
No, that was really, really nice. It was very poetic and, like, very, like, haunting, but also kind of, like, comforting. And it has lots of emotions.
Melancholy.
Melancholy, that's the one.
This is Off the Page.
At the end of each podcast, we have a serialized episode. If you want to listen to the first part of this piece that's been serialized, go to series 2, episode 1. So this is the second part. It's not a continuation, it's kind of a separate thing, but about the same characters. So the first piece was called Drained, and it was about a succubus who, if you don't know what a succubus is, they're basically a female sex demon who is in love with a human woman and how that relationship just can't work. And this piece is called Consumed. I'm just going to give this piece a little content warning. It does include mentions of violence and kind of dubious consent. "I'll have a scotch on the rocks," she said, and moments later the glass was placed in front of her. She opened her purse, but the bartender started shaking his head. "It's on the house, beautiful." She grinned at him and he melted. She took the drink and leant against the bar and watched the expanse of the club in front of her. There were bodies grinding against each other, the swaying of the heavy bass pounding against the walls, the ceiling, against the insides of her skull. They looked like the ripples of the ocean, dim under the strobe lights and moving in sync. There was a lot to watch at the club, but her eyes met his as soon as he descended the stairs onto the dance floor. She smirked at him and he smiled back. She pushed off the bar and strutted towards him, the sea of people parting effortlessly around her. She stopped in front of him, looked him in the eyes and said, "Your place or mine?" It ended up being hers, because she had planned it that way. He tried to kiss her 3 times on the way there, but she curved him each time with a devilish smile and a promise that he'd get what he wanted and more if he was patient and listened to her, if he did it her way. So later, when she had laid him down on her bed and handcuffed his wrist to the headboard, he was just grinning like a goddamn idiot. She moved away from him and he couldn't do anything to stop her. "Where are you going?" he asked. "We're doing this my way, right?" she said as she stood at the foot of the bed. "Of course, yeah, whatever you want." He sounded so eager she wanted to laugh. "Well, I want to show you something first." She turned on the TV opposite the bed. It took a moment for the screen to flicker on, but eventually a beautiful woman's face appeared on the screen. "Ooh," the man in the bed said, and she quelled the rush of anger inside of her. "Who is she?" She turned back to him and leant her hands on the bottom of the bed frame. He looked so stupid, half sat up in anticipation, hands cuffed to the headboard, eyes filled with lust. "Do you not remember her?" she asked, feigning confused innocence. He looked at her, uncertain for a moment. "Am I supposed to?" "Well," she moved towards him and sat on the bed. "After all," she leant down over him, "you were the last person to see her alive." He tried to recoil away from her, push as far back into the mattress as he could. "What?" She leant further over him. "You were the last person to see her alive." She said it like it was nothing, like she had just told him her favourite drink was coffee. He sputtered. "I don't know what you mean." He started squirming around, lifting his legs and hips off the bed, wrists pulling against the restraints. She just sat, perched on the edge of the bed and watched him with bored interest for a moment. "You know what you did. I just want you to admit it. That's all I want." It wasn't all she wanted, but she knew how to work men like him. Men who were small, pathetic cowards inside. Men who would sell someone out to save themselves. Men who would kill women in cold blood because they turned down his advances. He was still fighting, thrashing, screaming. She held him down with one strong hand on his chest. He looked at her, fear leaving his eyes and lust flooding back in. The fighting stopped and he lay limp against her sheets, eyes sparkling. "Just tell me what happened and I'll leave you alone," she said, and he looked at her for a moment, his eyes swimming in a mixture of fear and lust she knew too well. "You'll let me go?" His voice sounded so small it was ridiculous. "Of course. I..." There were tears welling in his eyes, but she looked down on him without pity. "I liked her. I asked her if she wanted to go on a date with me and she said no. She said she had a girlfriend and I told her that she just needed to meet the right guy. She argued with me, told me that she loved this girl and nothing was going to change that." His bottom lip was shaking, whether through fear or remorse she didn't care to know. "She left and I followed her home. I don't know what happened next." Her tether snapped and she gripped his face hard in a single hand. He yelped at the strength she crushed his jaw with. He was looking at her again. She saw his pupils dilate. "You know what happened next," she said, and her eyes began to well up. "You followed her home, you followed her up to her apartment, and as she tried to shut her door, you stuck your foot in the frame and let yourself in. And then you killed her." "No," he muttered. "And then you killed her." "No, no," he was muttering, but she ignored it. "You killed her because she turned you down, because she has a girlfriend who she loves and who isn't you, because you think you're entitled to women and to whatever you want. No, it didn't happen like that." He was a mess of tears and snot and pathetic little mumbles. There was a pause as she just watched him cry. "What is this? Who are you?" "My name is Lilith. I'm the girlfriend. I'm a succubus and I lied. I'm not going to let you go. I'm going to do what I do best. Fuck and kill."
Jesus Christ.
Oofed.
Oofed. Indeed.
For the happy ending, but also that ending worked very well.
Mm. I don't feel like they could have a happy ending.
Yeah.
Is it going to be like a fantastical whodunit?
Did he do it?
What? No. Oh yeah, the guy killed her.
I really didn't kill her.
But the idea that I had was there's this woman who like goes around and like kills men who've done bad things to other women, and then I was like, oh my god, that could totally be Lilith from the other piece, because like she is a bad bitch and like is a succubus and can like lure men in and then kill them, which like, you know, don't do that. Like, the justice system is good, mainly don't take things into your own hands, but also she's a queen. So that's the end of this episode of Off the Page. Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you've enjoyed it. Check out the links in our description for our SU page, social medias, and the blog. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
Crisp.
Crisp.
Pelosi.
All right, then, boys.